忙来嘛，不要输来等你的，不要输来等你的，来嘛来嘛，哎来哎来哎来哎，不要输来等你的，忙起来。
Hello, this is New Books in Southeast Asian Studies, coming to you via iTunes and the web. I'm Nick Cheeseman, a member of the Institute for Advanced Study, Princeton. Today's guest is Patrick Jory, Senior Lecturer in Southeast Asian History at the University of Queensland, who is joining us to discuss Thailand's theory of monarchy, the Waisantara Jataka, and the idea of the perfect man, published in 2016 by State University of New York Press and forthcoming in paperback in 2017. Patrick, it's great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Nick.
Let's get started with a thumbnail and unproblematized sketch of the Waisantara Jataka for listeners unfamiliar with either this Jataka or the Jataka stories in general. First of all, what are the Jataka and why do they matter?
Okay, well, the Jatakas are also known as birth stories. They're stories of the incarnations of the Buddha before he became the Buddha, that is, when he was a bodhisattva, what is known as a bodhisattva, a future Buddha. The Jatakas form part of the Tripitaka, the canonical scriptures of Theravada Buddhism. There are nominally 550 in number. The Waisantara Jataka is the final of those 550 Jatakas. So in other words, it's the story of the Buddha's previous incarnation to the incarnation when he is enlightened as the Buddha. And for that reason, because it's the final or the penultimate incarnation, it's an extremely important story in the overall structure of the narrative of the Buddha's enlightenment. It's a story of Prince Waisantara, who performs what is known as the perfection of giving. And this is one of the 10 perfections that the Bodhisattva, that is the future Buddha, needs to achieve before he has reached sort of a state of moral perfection that enables him to become enlightened as a Buddha. And arguably the most important of these perfections, known as the parami in Nepali or the barami in Thai, is the perfection of giving. And in this story, Prince Waisantara gives away everything he has. He gives away the white elephant of the kingdom which he is the prince, which gets him into trouble with the townsfolk. They experience from the kingdom. He gives away, progressively gives away all of his wealth. Most poignantly, he gives away his own children, his two children, Charlie and Gunhar, and his wife, Matsi. And in this great act of giving, he achieves perfection of giving. And that, as I say, is one of the requirements that he needs to fulfill in order to become enlightened as the Buddha in his next incarnation. So structurally, you could say it's almost, although it's all, you can kind of get into trouble with such comparisons, but it perhaps performs a sort of similar role to, you know, the story of the crucifixion in Christianity. This is a centrally important story the story of the Buddha.
So who or what got you interested in the topic, and how did it lead to a book-length study?
Sure. As you may know, Thai history tends to be quite elite-centric, and the further back you go, the more sort of elitist it is. Part of that is because of the nature of the source material, which tend to be produced by the court, court scholars, and such like. Part of it is because of Thailand's peculiar experience of colonial rule, where it wasn't formally colonized. So there is not a same kind of popular nationalism that you find in other Southeast Asian countries, which kind of is a kind of a counter to an elite sort of centered history. So I was trying to find, I wanted to write a kind of a sort of a history from below type study, and I was having trouble finding one. And my supervisor, Craig Reynolds, suggested I look at this story, the Waisantara Jataka, which was well known, that it was a very popular story in Thailand, an important Buddhist scripture, but important not simply amongst learned monks, but it was immensely popular at the village level amongst ordinary people. So I thought, aha, okay, here is a chance for me to kind of somehow get hold of a of an expression of popular culture, and somehow perhaps I could write some kind of cultural history from below as a sort of a foil to this sort of elitist type history that is so common in Thai historiography. So that was the original idea that set me off on this study.
What sort of materials did you use, and how did you use them when you were doing the research?
Yes, well, the first thing I did, of course, was to sit down and read the thing in the original Thai version, and I don't read Pali. I obviously read the English version, but I wanted to focus on the Thai language materials. So there are many versions of this story, and one of the things I look at in the book is the official versions and sort of various other versions that are popular in different parts of the country. So the version I used was the one that was sanctioned by the Thai Ministry of Education. And I actually discovered it's actually a source of some of the best known verse, poetic verse in sort of Thai literature. You know, some chapters, particularly the chapter when Visantra gives away his two children and his wife sort of comes back from the forest and she's sort of beside herself because the children have disappeared. It's just absolutely, the poetry is very moving. So it was a good thing to read. From a sort of an aesthetic point of view, the idea that I had was to look at different versions of this story in different parts of the country. So I'd seen the version that was compiled by the Thai court and later on the Ministry of Education, the official version, as it were. And I thought, if I look in sort of regional versions, I'll find maybe perhaps a counter narrative or at least variations, which might lead me into sort of understanding this text in a different way. So I had a year's field work in Thailand. I went around the country, and that's what I did. I sort of collected local versions and read through them. And as happens in PhD research, things turned out differently. I actually found out it was pretty much the same, wherever you went. That the central narrative, and there were other reasons for that, the central narrative was pretty much the same. Where there were variations were in, for example, the descriptions of flora and fauna. And actually, this is a really big part of the Visantra Jataka, which is, I didn't actually go down this path, but the descriptions of the forest and the plants and the animals are extremely detailed and again quite beautiful aesthetically, very aesthetically impressive. So it's just part of this corpus of knowledge of the environment. It also has this role, but so the as I say, the what I discovered was there were no real sort of subversive versions of this text. Although I should say there is another book coming out on the Visantra Jataka written by Catherine Bowie, who she argues that there are subversive versions of a kind. But I guess I went around a different route. I saw this as much more of a way that sort of, I guess, elitist discourse perhaps has been sort of localized throughout the kingdom.
Well, thanks for flagging Catherine Bowie's forthcoming book. Perhaps we'll have to get both of you on together to discuss that.
That would be fun.
Anyway, we're getting ahead of ourselves. Let's go into the contents of the Jataka a bit more now, and specifically your emphasis upon it as offering a pre-modern theory of monarchy. This is really the argument that you're making as to why, one of the reasons at least, as to why it became so significant. Can you spell out some of the basic elements of the Buddhist ideology of kingship that you found in the Jataka?
Okay, I should maybe preface these comments by saying that one of the most exciting articles for me when I was a PhD student was reading Benedict Anderson's The Idea of Power in Javanese Culture. And although I know it's been criticised since, but what I thought it did was it enabled you to kind of understand a sort of indigenous sort of theory of power or politics based on local religious and cultural understanding, which had a sort of a textual basis rather than the tools of modern Western political science. So that was quite inspiring for me. I thought, well, perhaps I can look at, perhaps I could do something similar for a Thai political culture, focusing on the Visantra Jataka. There has actually been quite a lot of literature, scholarly literature, written on the Satra Jataka, but it's always been presented as a religious tale or a literary tale, a folk tale. And where I guess sort of departed from that was I saw this, the more and more I looked at it, and the more I read this kind of complex of both Buddhist literature and also court literature, historiography, chronicles and sort of pre-modern historiography, if you like, I could see that it was it was related to ideas of power, authority, and morality, of course. So this is what set me off on, I wanted to sort of start off, the project sort of start off by me wanting to kind of write some kind of counter-narrative to sort of an elitist view of Thai history, but in the end I ended up actually kind of looking at this theory, what I ended up referring to as a theory of monarchy. So the argument is that the Satra Jataka and this complex of Buddhist literature really provided a sort of a storehouse of ideas for a Theravada Buddhist theory of monarchy, which I would argue, or I did argue, was present at the Thai court really up until the middle of the 19th century and goes into decline in really the second half of the 19th century. According to this theory of monarchy, the Thai kings present themselves as bodhisattvas, that is, as Buddhas to be, in the same mode as Prince Visantra in the Visantra Jataka. That is, they are beings, moral beings, that are on the path towards enlightenment. So if you look at the Jataka stories of the Bodhisattva, commonly they are princes or kings, sometimes a Brahmin, sometimes a merchant, but more often they are royalty. So basically this religious literature should be, I argue, understood as a pre-modern theory of monarchical authority. That's the essential argument of the book.
And maybe break that down a little bit more. What were the nature of the relations between the ruler and his subjects? And they were all men. This particular Jataka is trying to get at and spell out somewhat didactically for the purposes of instruction of the subjects of the kingdom.
In the Jatakas, and as I say, in this broader collection of texts, which from which which are related to this understanding of the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva is the most meritorious being in the kingdom. So he has accumulated merit, that is, good deeds, over countless lifetimes, thousands of lifetimes in theory. So society is really in a kind of a moral hierarchy. So you have the most meritorious beings on the top, led by the Bodhisattva at the top, and the least meritorious beings at the bottom. So you have slaves, peasants, and such like. So the Visantra Jataka and the Jatakas more broadly support this idea that political authority and moral authority are one and the same. The Bodhisattva king is the most the purest being in the kingdom, morally purest being in the kingdom, and that is the moral legitimacy that enables him to be the monarch as well. This moral purity also enables him, and this is a point that actually Christine Gray develops in her 1986 thesis very well, that this moral purity enables the kings to see more clearly because they're not under the influence of greed, delusion and all the other vices. They can see more clearly than anyone else. So this helps develop a theory that the kings are the most, the wisest, most intellectually capable people in the kingdom as well. So it essentially kind of creates this moral, intellectual and political hierarchy which operated into the Thai Kingdom, I would argue, up until the, you know, the coming of the European colonial powers.
So if you were pressed by someone like me, for instance, how would you class this study? Would you say your study of the Jataka, is it a study of comparative political theory or an intellectual history or both or neither, something else?
I was attracted to comparative political theory, but to be honest, I dropped it. I felt that it was enough to just to write sort of an intellectual theory of this interesting conception of monarchy. Early on, I knew this. The Jatakas generally were popular, you know, throughout the Theravada regions of Southeast Asia, Sri Lanka as well. But I think, you know, it would be interesting for a future scholar to look at how these stories function in, for example, pre-modern Myanmar. I think Cambodia and Laos are closer to the Thai tradition, perhaps also Sri Lanka. But I guess you could say it's much more of an intellectual and a pretty kind of empirical sort of intellectual history rather than an example of comparative political theory study.
So you've already mentioned that the book tracks the rise and decline of the Jataka. Let's start with the rise. What period are we talking about, and what do the extant records show about the relationship between this Jataka and early state formation in mainland Southeast Asia?
Yeah, I have a chapter that, the main point I wanted to make was that from the very early period of Thai state formation, we see the Jatakas appear immediately. So right back in the, from the sort of 14th century, if not earlier, we see the Jatakas referred to in inscriptions. There are representations of the Jatakas, carved in stone, and by the 15th century, we get the oldest Thai text, Thai translated text of the Vasantara Jataka. So whenever we see a sort of an expansion of the Thai state, or as we saw in the late 15th century with the kind of increasing, complexity and sort of a surge in sort of legal codification too under the King Boromodrai Lokanat, we see the Jatakas and the Vasantara Jataka in particular get a lot of attention in the inscriptions from this period. So there's an obvious connection between the political ideas that are being expressed in the Jatakas and the expansion of the Thai state, and from at least the 14th century right up until the early 19th century we see that. So they are, I'm just sort of kind of supported my argument. I hope that this is a text that is politically very important. It's not just in the realm of religious or literary discourse.
And what was the secret of its success in its distribution? Other than its contents, how did it manage to become so popular? They didn't have internet, obviously. So what was the technology, in a sense, that was being used to make this Jataka widely known and to make it such a significant part, not only of the religious and cultural, but also political life of the kingdom?
Yeah, in the book I give quite a lot of attention to the performative aspect of this text. Unlike a lot of Buddhist scripture, this text was meant to be recited aloud to a popular audience. And almost as far back as records go, this is the case. So, from the 15th century, we have the first translated version of the Vasantara Jataka, the Mahachatkam Luang, which when it's translated, it is meant to be recited to an audience that understands Thai, not just to Pali literate Buddhist monks. So as I say, I think this distinguishes it from a lot of Buddhist discourse, which is purely in Pali. So it's meant to be recited to an audience. And we, by the by the 16th, 17th century, it's clear that there is a ritual that is established, if not earlier. I mean, it's almost it's almost certain that the ritual started earlier, of reciting this text to an audience. And this became one of the at one stage the most important ritual occasion of the Buddhist calendar. So every year you would have the text recited in its entirety, all 13 verses, over the course of the day, and you know all the faithful would come and listen to this text. And the reason that they came to listen, well, amongst the reasons that they came to listen, was that there was another very famous text, the Pramalai story, where this Buddhist monk, you know, it's a bit like the Dante story, sort of travels to the heavens and travels to the hells. And in heaven, he meets the future Buddha. This is Prasyarya Medrai, Maitreya, the future Buddha. And Maitreya Pramalai says, asks Maitreya, okay, what should I tell the people on earth if they want to sort of meet you in the future? And Maitreya tells him, make sure that they listen to the Vasantra Jataka and make sure they listen to the 1,000 canonical verses which form part of the Vasantra Jataka within one day. So this kind of sets out the ritual of the Vasantra Jataka. You have the recitation of these Pali verses which are supposedly by tradition believed to have been uttered by the Buddha himself. So these must be recited in one day. If the faithful listen to these 1,000 verses, then they can be guaranteed that they will, you know, be reincarnated in the lifetime of Maitreya Buddha. So it has this very sort of millenarian element to it. But it wasn't just the canonical verses which in Pali which were recited. The translation was always recited as well, so you could understand the actual story. So the whole festival sometimes would, you know, take place over 7 days. It'd be an occasion of great merit making. And this is also another element which makes the story enormously important for the monkhood, because the emphasis of the story is on merit making, giving alms to the monkhood. So there's an element of self-interest here, that is that the monkhood needs to be, you know, sustained materially. And this story, with its emphasis on the perfection of giving, really is a story that really promotes, I guess, really sort of the circulation of wealth from communities into the monkhood. So for all these reasons, I'm sorry?
I was just going to add, also, you mentioned in the text the narrative structure also is important somehow. How did that make it particularly useful for the purposes of dissemination, and how did it differ from other religious texts that might be read over a number of days? Certainly this particular Jataka isn't the only one.
Absolutely, and the most famous versions of the Vasantra Jataka or chapters of the Vasantra Jataka are written either by kings or princes or people in the royal Thai court. We know that it was a kind of like a coming of age ritual for princes to recite the Vasantra Jataka. It was one of the most important royal ceremonies of the calendar. So there's a very close association between the aristocracy and the nobility and the recitation of the Vasantra Jataka right from the very beginning. And that continues up until the late 19th century, this association with the Thai elite.
So you mentioned a number of features of the context of the performance of this Jataka, and one of the things I really liked and was really interested in the book was the emphasis that you do place on reading the Jataka not in isolation as a doctrinal religious text, as other scholars have done, but rather by attending to the social and political conditions in which it was taught and the manner in which it was taught, which you've just spoken to. Would you like to say anything else about the importance of context, why it matters, and how do you, as an historian, read and research for context?
Yeah, I think you need to see the Visantra Jataka within this broader, as I say, complex of Buddhist literature and a kind of like a Buddhist historiographical conception that has more or less has largely disappeared in a way. That is that the person whose work I used to outline this historiographical conception was a guy called Niti Osi Wong, probably Thailand's preeminent historian of the last 30 or 40 years. And he looked at how this conception of Buddhist history, which goes back to the pledge of the Bodhisattva, who would later on be incarnated finally as Gautama Buddha, the Buddha that we know, countless incarnations in the past. He makes a pledge. He's a Brahmin in this early incarnation. He makes a pledge to the Buddha of that time. I think he was the fifth or the sixth Buddha in this series of 25 Buddhas. He makes a pledge at the feet of this Buddha, Dipankara, who incidentally is the name of the crown prince's young son, the Thai crown prince's young son today. He makes a pledge that in the future I want to become a Buddha. So, and if you look at Thai or even Lao. Some of the Lao material I looked at as well, some of the Northern Thai material. If you look at sort of pre-modern chronicles, they will often start off by this pledge that the Bodhisattva made to Dipankara. And the Visantra Jataka, so it fits into this schema of the Bodhisattva, accumulating merit, accumulating the perfections over countless incarnations, up until the Visantra Jataka, which is the very, the penultimate incarnation before he becomes the Buddha. So this is kind of the central historical narrative for the Theravada Buddhists up until the late 19th century, and Niti kind of shows how the life when books which sort of Buddhist literature which talk about the life of the Buddha prior to about the mid 19th century, the actual human lifetime of the Buddha took up a very small part of this story. It was actually these incarnations prior to that. It was the stories in the Jatakas. And then there's this rather sort of short section which talks about the human lifetime of the Buddha. By the mid-19th century and later on, it's the human life of the Buddha that gets central attention, and the earlier the earlier incarnations are gradually sort of hived off, as it were. And Niti argues that this is a kind of a sign of a much more humanistic and modern understanding of society and of the individual, which is reflected in the stories of the lifetime of the Buddha. So part of what the book is about is showing how this pre-modern conception of Buddhist history in a way comes into crisis by the second half of the 19th century related to the coming of the European colonial powers and a new conception of a new historical conception. And new conception of the history of the Thai state as well.
I think you've pretty much asked the next question yourself. Let's just keep moving with that point. Tell us something more about the decline of this Jataka. What were the implications with the coming of the Europeans? And how did the ruling Thai monarchy deal with this situation?
This is really the crux of the book. I, for a long time, as many PhD students will have the experience, you're not quite sure what you're doing. And then one day I found this article by King Tula Longkorn. And it was quite an extraordinary article written in the early 1902, I think it was, where he basically discredits the Jatakas as a genre of literature, or as a genre of Buddhist literature, saying they're basically just folk tales. You shouldn't take them too seriously. Yeah, they're enjoyable read, They form part of the corpus of Thai literature, but they, you know, they're full of all kinds of, you know, miraculous events which no one, you know, believes anymore. And for me, who had read, you know, the early literature, which for which the Jatakas were this central, you know, component of Buddhist understanding, it was quite remarkable. So that kind of, I thought that was the sort of the gotcha moment, if you like, where I thought, okay, I might have a thesis here. That there's the Jatakas have gone through this period of crisis where the Thai court, which had promoted these stories as being really stories about, you know, about what it is to be the ideal ruler, were being rejected at the highest levels. And then there are two kind. I mean, I think it's a complex process. It takes place both on the level of monastic scholarship, and it's obviously related to the changing sort of geopolitical situation in Southeast Asia with the coming of the European colonial powers, the coming of you know, Western education, Western knowledge, and the need for the Thai court to engage with and to a certain extent kind of transform themselves in a way that would enable them to survive this period. So at a monastic level, as I outline in the book, we see there is a strand of Buddhist scholarship associated actually with King Dulongkorn's father, King Mongkut, when he was in the monkhood, which he actually starts up this very famous reformist Buddhist order, the Tamayut, which later on becomes a sort of a political vehicle for him, really, to kind of secure the throne later on. But this, the Tamayut scholars take a much more critical view of the Jatakas. They are the sect, if you like, that abandons the recitation of the Vasantra Jataka, quite a radical thing to do. Even though King Mongkut himself, he kind of, like, I guess, as kings have to do, they sort of have to make compromises, and he actually composed a version of the Vasantra Jataka, and he sort of, you know, recited it as part of his sort of coming of age ritual. But by that time, we could sort of see within Thai a certain strand of Thai monastic scholarship, the Jatakas were falling into disfavor, and this continues through the late 19th century. There's another strand of monastic scholarship, of Buddhist scholarship, I should say, which becomes very important. That is when Western scholars start investigating and examining Buddhism. Which they encounter mostly through through the colonization of Buddhist countries. So you're getting people like the famous one is Rhys David's book on the Buddhist birth stories, which is the first kind of full-length study of the Jatakas, which portrays the Jatakas more as a storehouse of folk literature that came from, you know, India in the periods before the common era, rather than any sort of meaningful Buddhist literature. And it turns out that the Thai monastic scholars at the court level were reading this scholarship as well. Reading this, you know, the English language scholarship on the Jatakas and on other sort of related texts, which are quite disparaging of the type of Buddhism, if you like, that is presented in the Jatakas. And it turns out that King Dulongkorn's essay was basically modelled on Rhys David's study of the Jatakas. So this is a case of a Buddhist kingdom, scholars of a Buddhist kingdom actually taking up the Western Buddhist scholarship produced by these colonial scholars, which for whom the Jatakas weren't the real Buddhism, and it got to an extent where in the 1893 publication of the first Tripitaka, that corpus of canonical Theravada Buddhist scriptures, published in the Thai script, the first ever publication of the Buddhist canonical scriptures in the Thai script, they omitted the Jataka book and a number of other books which are related to the Jataka book, which showed you the how the Jatakas have been discredited within both the sort of elite Thai scholarship as well as sort of international Buddhist scholarship. You know, people involved with the Pali Text Society and others. So we could sort of see that there's a sort of a scholarly movement against the legitimacy of the Jatakas. So I outlined that in the book. But I think the other aspect of it was the political ideas that the Jatakas helped promote, the idea of the Bodhisattva King. By the late 19th century, with the colonial pressures on the Thai court, these ideas were seen to be, were ridiculed, in fact, by Western colonial scholars, and the Thai monarchy, the Thai court, undergoes this transformation by which they start to present themselves in a different way, in the manner of a, I guess you could say, sort of enlightened, if you like, enlightened European style monarchy. So this is a period in which both the canonical legitimacy of the Jatakas is discredited, as well as the ideas that the Jatakas helped sustain and promote, they are rejected by the Thai court at the highest levels.
This is really one of the really rich parts of the text, and there are so many layers that we could go into that we don't have time to cover. But speaking of time, one of the subsidiary points that caught my eye that I'd be really interested to hear about from you briefly is how, with the idea of historical time and the sense of history as a discipline, the notion of what the Jatakas were and their place in relation to other texts changed. Would you like to comment on that before we move on to other topics?
That's right. So within this pre-modern Buddhist conception of time, the Jatakas were actually central because they told the story of the Bodhisattva before he becomes the Buddha. And they told this absolutely central story of the Bodhisattva accumulating the perfections, the Bharami, which was the prerequisite to becoming, to perfecting yourself to such a level where you could become enlightened as a Buddha. So they're central to the story of Buddhism and the story of the person of the Buddha. But within historical time, and this is something that the Rhys Davids and other European scholars are trying to show, that there is, they actually, on historical and sort of textual grounds, critical textual grounds, there is no historical veracity. Jewel Longhorn takes this up himself. He's saying, by saying that, these stories, they're not true. They're just folk tales. So a new kind of criterion of historical truth is accepted really by the Thai court at this time, by which the Jatakas can no longer be accepted as historical truth. But it's very difficult for the, I think it's a case in which all modernizing, colonized countries face, where they it's very hard to completely reject your own tradition and accept this foreign cultural religious tradition, but you need to kind of sort of, I guess, repackage it or manage it in a different way. And what happens with the Jatakas is that they are repackaged. And I would say, King Jewel Longhorn and the scholarly elite at this time, this is what they try and do, is they repackage the Jatakas as folk tales, essentially, as not true stories, but folk tales which are kind of the part of the corpus of Thai literature. And because there's so many of them, you can't ignore them. They are just everyone knows these stories. You can't completely reject them. But what you can do is to represent them as being part of the literary heritage, if you like, of the Thai nation. This is the era where ideas of the Thai nation are starting to be starting to form. And so this is the way that the Jatakas are represented. And there's this, as I talk about in the book, there's a sort of publication project that publishes these stories as folk tales, essentially, with and the you know the publications are accompanied almost always by as this happens in Thailand with the essay by King Chulalongkorn saying how the Jatakas should be read, not as you know true stories, nothing really to do with Buddhism, but as you know as folk tales which are an enjoyable read and part of Thailand's literary heritage.
All right. Now, you said earlier on that you were interested in thinking through the Jatakas, also the storytelling from below, and we went through all of the earlier periods in which the Jatakas were so much a part of people's daily lives, and the Wasantara Jataka in particular. So was there any pushback from different parts of the country, perhaps hinterland regions that weren't yet well integrated with the administration at the centre? Did people object to these attempts to rationalise and transform their understanding of the Jatakas in ways that were different from how they'd practised them for so long? Did they remain impervious? Did the old practices continue despite the efforts of Bangkok, or did Bangkok in fact succeed?
Yeah, this is a good question, and I have been sort of criticised on these grounds too. I think Justin McDaniel has written some good stuff on this. Like a lot of the reforming efforts embarked upon by the Thai court, they're most effective at the centre, but the further out of the royal city you go, the less effective they are. And it appears that in the countryside, where obviously the majority of the population lived, the Jatakas and the Vasantra Jataka also, remained as popular forever, remained as popular as ever, for a long time. Over time, I think even in the last three or four decades, even in the provinces, its popularity has declined, but much more slowly than one might have expected. So it begins with these quite strong efforts by the Thai court at the turn of the 20th century, but it takes quite a long time before the Jatakas and the beliefs which they espouse sort of fade in the rural areas, and that's sort of the point that I come back to in the final chapter.
Well, let's move to that final chapter. And in that final chapter, among other things, you end the book by saying that we might look upon the recently passed away King Bhumibol as Thailand's modern Wasantara. Would you care to explain?
Yes. So the book is kind of the focus of the book is really this pivotal moment where the Jatakas are rejected and sort of represented as folk tales, and at this very moment of obviously that the Thai monarchy is trying to transform itself, as I say, into the along the lines of the model, progressive, modernizing, enlightened European monarchs, and I think the older idea of monarchy, which is sustained by the Jatakas and its associated literature. This continues in the countryside for a long time to come. Modern education starts to become increasingly, expands out the countryside, and people are very gradually, starts to replace monastic education, but it takes quite a long time. So the point is that these ideas, although they're kind of rejected by the Thai court, which is trying to present itself as a modern monarchy, and of course, after the overthrow of the absolute monarchy in 1932, the monarchy is really to a large extent out of the picture before its restoration at the end of the 1940s, and particularly the end of the 1950s. So I think what happens with the restoration of the monarchy under King Bhumibol is that you get, to use the Weberian idea, that sort of a re-enchantment of the monarchy with these religious ideas. And again, this is something that Christine Gray has written on very, very nicely, that all of this sort of pre-modern these pre-modern ideas that the Jatakas had expressed is sort of revived from about the 1960s, and starts to kind of envelop you know, the monarchy under King Pumipon, and really perhaps not so much the monarchy, but the person, the monarch, King Pumipon himself. The ideas of the king as a bodhisattva, as a future Buddha, is revived. And I think this needs to be looked at quite carefully because, of course, I think the monarchy, the way that the image handlers, if you like, manage the monarchy's public relations, if you like, it does change over time. So we see early on he's the development king, or firstly, you know, he's the jazz king, the kind of the cool modern guy. You know, he's a sportsman, he's a painter, he's a bit of a Renaissance man. Later on, he's the development king. You know, he's out there, you know, trying to develop the countryside. He has a very during the Cold War period, he's almost always in military uniform, so there is that sort of that martial element that is promoted in the fight against communism. But even during this period, you're getting a much more, the religious conceptions start to be emphasized more and more. And I think in the 1990s, with the end of the Cold War, that these sort of come to the fore even more strongly. And the king himself, as I discuss in the book, in his, you might sort of say, his kind of his writerly phase, he goes through this phase where he starts writing books, which become, you know, they're endlessly promoted, of course. And the one of the most famous ones was his book on the Mahajanaka Jataka. The Mahajanaka Jataka, Pamahajanok in Thai, is one of the last 10 Jataka stories. So the last 10 Jataka stories are the famous ones. So the Visantra Jataka is the very last one. The Mahajanaka, I think it's the fifth or the sixth one. And so it's a story of the Bodhisattva. And this story, it's of a king who is exiled from his kingdom and he wants to, you know, return to his kingdom and reclaim the throne. This, you know, each of those 10 Jatakas, the final 10 Jatakas, are supposed to express one of the 10 perfections. This is based on the Buddhist theory of the 10 perfections, the 10 parami. And in this book is the perfection of perseverance, you know, trying hard. And so he writes this book. So basically he is essentially, you know, presenting himself, as I say in the book, it's essentially an allegory of his own reign as a modern bodhisattva. It's quite a remarkable thing. And I think if you look at the immense, extraordinary sort of charismatic authority that the king was able to amass, really, particularly in the latter decades of his reign, which we're sort of seeing now in the outpourings of grief and mourning following his death, I think it really is a product of the way that the monarchy has been really has sort of reconnected with these Buddhist roots, by which the king is not a modernizing, well, I guess that's in there as well, but he is this, you know, pious, perfect being, a future Buddha. I think that comes out quite clearly. You know, we can sort of see that idea quite clearly since his passing away, if not before.
Well, that's a response really brings me to one of my final questions, or perhaps it's a request of sorts. We probably, hopefully, have some undergraduate and graduate students listening, and maybe some of yours as well, Patrick. If you were to hold up this text as an example of Southeast Asian studies history and make a pitch to students about what we can learn about Southeast Asia today through study of its past, a history of the present, as it were, then what would you say to them?
Yeah, I think, particularly from a student point of view, a lot of the way we sort of understand Southeast Asia is seen through the lens of the mass media, and they have their job, and we can't, you know, they're doing their job. But it tends to be dominated by, I guess, a rather the way the West, I guess, sort of sees monarchy in this case. And what I wanted to show in the book is that I wanted to kind of try and reveal the way sort of an indigenous understanding of monarchy, to see how, you know, people within this particular country understands monarchy. And that's not to, you know, kind of say that that's the only way of seeing it, but I think we should understand how people within these countries understand these things on, you know, on their own terms as one factor in explaining, you know, explaining how the Thai monarchy of all, I mean, if you think about the Thai monarchy in by comparison with you know, monarchies around the world, it is extraordinarily successful, has been. How can we explain this? Now, that would be a long answer, but I think you can't understand it unless you understand. Part of the explanation, I would say, is understanding how, you know, people within this country understand. And I'd say to do that, you need to understand this this Buddhist theory of monarchy on which it's based.
I felt in reading the text like you were in some ways, you weren't saying this, but perhaps implying that if someone approached the study of contemporary politics in Thailand through the lens of, say, Weberian or Marxist theory, then they're likely to misapprehend what they see, and that an appreciation of current events is contingent on some understanding of pre-modern Buddhist political theories. Indeed, you refer to the monarchy in Thailand as superficially modernized. Would you care to comment on that?
Yeah, thanks for pointing that out. I think one of the things that developing countries have to do is to present themselves, to make themselves look acceptable in the eyes of more powerful powers, which to a certain extent, you know, set the frameworks by which these countries, you know, operate. And I think, you know, the Thai monarchy has been very successful in doing this, in presenting themselves as this, you know, these sort of these modern monarchs, and as I say, according to the kind of the European model. But this older understanding, I think it's never gone away because it has such deep roots. I mean, it just goes back, you know, 800 years, and arguably, I mean, if you look at the Buddhist tradition prior to that in Southeast Asia, you can see these ideas. There are old representations of bodhisattvas, you know, in stone going back to, I think, the 5th or the 6th century of the Common Era. These are ancient ideas, and they don't just go away, you know, over the course of, you know, a few decades of European, you know, colonial, you know, I think, quite intensive penetration. They're still there, perhaps not in the same form, but we have to understand that. I think you need to kind of get beyond that sort of superficial presentation of the monarchy in this case, not just the monarchy. There are other institutions you can look at, and just look at the ideas within these societies on which these institutions are based.
Right. I'm aware that you've been doing some work in more recent times on lineages of Republican thought in Thai political culture. So is the sequel to this book on the theory of monarchy going to be the theory of republicanism, or maybe flora and fauna of the Charakas or something else?
Yeah, maybe it was a reaction against working for such a long time on monarchy. And also a reaction, of course, against the way that Thailand is always presented as this, you know, deeply monarchical country where, you know, everyone loves the king, et cetera, et cetera. And it's out there for anyone to discover that Thailand actually has a very old tradition of republicanism. I would argue, you know, one of the oldest traditions of republicanism in Southeast Asia. And it was popular really up until not so long ago. And it's really been during the reign of this king where that old tradition has been really largely successfully suppressed. But yeah, it's still around. There are sort of Republican websites I see now. And of course, part of the crisis of the last 10 years has been due to or claims on the part of the royalists that there is a plot to overthrow the monarchy. So yeah, this idea of republicanism within modern Thailand has never really gone away. But so I have done some work on republicanism, but I've actually moved on to something a little bit different. I'm very interested in ideas of proper behavior, manners, morality. So that's the project that I'm not a million miles away from the theory of monarchy, but looking much more at ideals of individual behaviour, not just for, you know, monarchs or aristocrats, but for everyday people.
What time period are you concentrating on for that work?
I'm looking at the period. I want to write something which, again, I guess it's part of this whole interest in modernisation that I haven't sort of lost interest in. So from, again, the late 19th century up until the period of economic modernisation, so I guess from the 60s to the 1980s, in which sort of ideas of how to behave undergo quite interesting transformations.
Well, Patrick Jury, thanks a lot for taking the time to come on to New Books in Southeast Asian Studies to talk about Thailand's theory of monarchy, the Wisantara Jataka, and the idea of the perfect man.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And again, just to note that the paperback also will be out in 2017, as I understand. So everyone do get a copy. And if you have a suggestion for another book or an author that you'd like featured on this podcast, do send me an email at nick.cheesman, that's C-H-E-E-S-M-A-N, at anu.edu.au to let me know. Hey, make us get the tender boat. Monkey!